Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Governor Kathy Hochul and New York State lawmakers are closing in on a deal that could speed up housing construction in the Empire State. The New York Public News Network's John Campbell reports it's all part of ongoing state budget negotiations.
Jeff Morrell is walking me through a construction zone in the city of Troy, just north of Albany. He's the head of Rosenblum Companies, the developer behind the project.
Our challenge was to design and build a building that was contextually appropriate given these beautiful brownstones, these historic brownstones that are across the street.
The project's been in development for 4 years. It'll be home to 71 apartments once it opens this summer. But the developer says it could have opened sooner if not for a lengthy state-mandated review process.
Easily could have shaved like half a year, and that was with a relatively good outcome.
He's talking about the State Environmental Quality Review Act, or SEQR. It's a 51-year-old state law that can require an extensive study of a project's environmental impacts. Governor Hochul says it often adds major delays to housing construction, which drives up costs. And she wants to change that.
I'm talking about cutting the red tape, breaking down barriers, and letting communities build.
The governor and legislative leaders in Albany are nearing an agreement to exempt certain housing projects from the review process. The governor wants it to apply to projects with up to 500 units in denser areas of New York City and up to 100 units in the rest of the state. She's got support from New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani. Sadia Sherman is the city planning director.
We're certainly focused on making sure that we're able to bring these housing projects, which in New York City are pretty modest, right, at that scale, to neighborhoods more quickly.
But the governor is still negotiating the details with state lawmakers. Some of them want her to increase the number of units in densely populated areas that need more housing supply. Conservationists are split on the measure. Some say SEQR is a landmark law that must be protected. Others say building dense housing has its own environmental benefits. Democratic State Senator Rachel May of Syracuse falls into the latter camp.
You're giving something up in terms of environmental protection, but you're gaining it if people are driving less and you've got walkable communities.
The exemption is expected to be part of a final state budget, which is now more than 4 weeks late. Lawmakers will return to the Capitol on Monday to continue negotiating. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Courtney Gross, investigative reporter with New York One. She has a new prison series called Behind the Walls, and it looks into the prison system across the state. Courtney begins by telling me how she gathered her information.
So after the death of Robert Brooks in December 2024, I mean, just for a way of background, I've covered the correctional system down here in the form of Rikers Island, which I'm sure everyone across the state is very familiar with, that notorious jail complex. I've covered that for many, many years for New York One. And after the death of Robert Brooks, we often, just as New York One, by the nature of its proximity and the fact that we cover mostly the five boroughs, even though we are a statewide network, I mostly focused on what was happening within the city. And Robert Brooks was a city resident, so was Messiah Nantwi, and we decided that it was time for us to venture beyond the city's borders and take a look at what was happening upstate. I mean, so many of the inmates in upstate prisons are actually from the five boroughs, because that's where the highest concentration of crime is in New York State. So they end up serving some time on Rikers Island. They go through their trial or they plead guilty, and then they head upstate. If you have a sentence for longer than a year, that's where you end up going. So we felt like this was fair game, and we wanted to take a really good look, a deep look, at what was happening in our 41 state prisons all across the state. So we filed a Freedom of Information Law request, and that was shortly after the death of Robert Brooks, and it took us about 9 months.
Nine months
to get our information back. And we weren't asking for anything entirely complex. We were asking for disciplinary records. We were asking for stats about use of force or excessive force within the state's prison complexes, as well as just more detailed records on disciplinary and any kind of violence occurring in state prisons. We wanted to see, I think most people knew after the death of Robert Brooks that perhaps this wasn't a one-off occasion, that perhaps this was indicative or a sign of how violent and dangerous our state prison system has become.
Yeah, and Courtney Gross, you know, the other side of this is after the murder of Robert Brooks, there was the Wildcat strike, guards who walked off the job. And there is a side here that there's more, and you talk about the violence is up on staff and prison guards, and this and the staffing is, they say, not adequate. And you even had, after the governor said, if you don't get back to work, I'm going to fire you, and fired them, you now have National Guards people in the prisons still. And so it's a complex picture, isn't it?
Yeah, there is a huge staffing crisis. And as part of this investigation, we sat down with the Correction Officers Union that represents thousands of correction officers and sergeants all across the state. And they discussed their grievances with us. I mean, a lot of this goes back to the HALT Act, which was passed by the state legislature a number of years ago, went into effect, I believe, in 2022. And that limited greatly the use of solitary confinement or segregation in New York State prisons. It had practically been unlimited before, where you would hear these stories, these anecdotes of people being kept in solitary confinement for months, years at a time. And what the HALT Act did was limited it to 15 days. And then there were some other segregated units where people could go if they were violent within the state prison system that were punitive. But it was certainly not like the way that solitary confinement had been run in New York State for quite some time. So after that, the State Correction Officers Union said that that was the reason why the system was getting more violent, is that they no longer had a disciplinary measure that would actually keep some of the more violent inmates in line. And we've spoken with some advocates who say that there is some truth to that. It's not entirely the reason why the system has become more violent and use of force is up really across the board by correction officers, but that they do have a point that it did contribute in some way to the uptick in violence. There's another element that the Correction Officers Union talks about a lot, is that prior to, you know, the most recent reforms and the HALT Act included, they used to have something called keep lock, which was this sort of policy where they allowed or they put inmates in their cell for 24 hours at a time, not necessarily in the solitary confinement unit, but it segregated people. They say it allowed people to calm down, but advocates and others, especially advocates for the inmates themselves, say that that was unnecessarily punitive and was not a civil rights measure that this New York State should operate. And that is something that the Correctional Officers Union says, that doing away with that keep lock system, also increased violence in state prisons. And they say they have a staffing crisis. I think most people acknowledge that they do. I mean, they are trying to hire correction officers all across the state right now. In fact, even the governor and the state corrections department reduced the age of a correction officer. It had been 21 years old. Now it's 18. I mean, there are some limits of what you can and cannot do if you're 18 years old and get this job, but that is how desperate they are for employees. There are still 2,700 members of the National Guard that are within our state prison system after that strike, because they just do not have the staff to run programs, to make sure, you know, guys are going to school and make sure that everybody is safe.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, too. You talked to one of the, I believe it was a prison guard in this part of the series. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. you know, he talked about this feeling among the prison guards. You know, they see themselves as first responders. You know, they're in the prisons, they're dealing with these prisoners and have to deal with violent episodes. And yet, when there's talk of prisons on the outside, it's usually about prisoner abuse by the corrections mm-hmm. officers. And they felt kind of overlooked.
Yeah, and that's the story you hear down here in New York City in the jail complex here on Rikers Island. The Correctional Officers Union says the same thing. And the union upstate through our state prisons says that they aren't treated the same as your cops or nurses or firefighters, that they're looked at as almost second-tier first responders, and that's not fair considering they're trying to keep the state prison systems operating correctly and safely. And they're so short-staffed that many of them, the Correctional Officers Union says, aren't able to take vacation, aren't able to spend time with their families. When we asked the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision whether that was true, they said in an interestingly worded statement that they provide time off basically when they can for officers. So it wasn't a real guarantee that yeah. these guys and women are getting the time off. And we know, anyone knows, if you work doubles and triples and you work 14 hours or 14 days in a row, that is no way any reason to become violent. But that's going to change the morale within the department and going to change the way that the department and the people who are running it and who are running our state prisons, how they work and how they see their jobs. And if morale is down, then things aren't just not going to operate effectively.
That's Courtney Gross, investigative reporter with New York One. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York state government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Republican gubernatorial candidate Bruce Blakeman recently got FaceTime with North Country voters. As recent polling continues to indicate, nearly two-thirds of New Yorkers don't know enough about the Long Island County executive to form an opinion. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports.
Saturday was Bruce Blakeman's second visit to Clinton County as he took part in a local event to kick off the campaigns of local and statewide Republican candidates. He urged those in attendance to get out and make sure Republicans are elected to every open seat.
This is not a campaign. This is a battle for the heart and soul of the state of New York. We are at a tipping point. People are miserable. We are the most overtaxed, overregulated state in the United States of America.
Blakeman criticized Democrats and Governor Kathy Hochul on a number of issues, including the state's green energy plan.
NYSERDA is sitting with $2.4 billion of your money that they want to invest in the coming year in the green energy scam. When I become governor, we're going to give you that money back. It's going to go back to the people. And we're going to drill, baby, drill.
The GOP gubernatorial candidate slammed the state's immigration policies and New York's sanctuary state status.
I'm pro-immigration. This country was founded on immigration. We need a comprehensive immigration program. I'm all for that. But what I'm not for is people coming here illegally and getting things that our taxpayers don't get. And it will stop on day one when I become governor.
In February 2025, corrections officers across the state walked off the job, calling for repeal of the HALT Act, a measure that restricts solitary confinement. Some were fired, and the National Guard is still filling their roles in prisons across the state. Corrections officer Kevin Dwyer from Peru, New York, asked Blakeman what he would do about the situation.
There's nothing but chaos inside this prison.
under the HALT Act, the prisoners are running the jails, not the corrections officers. When I become governor, the lunatics will no longer be running the asylum. Our corrections officers will be safe, our community secure, and I promise you this, any corrections officer that was fired, I will rehire them.
The latest Siena poll indicated 64% of respondents either hadn't heard of Blakeman or didn't know enough to form an opinion. However, it also indicated the GOP challenger had cut Hochul's February lead from 20 points to 13. He is confident that any polling shortcoming will be erased by Election Day.
At this same time, 4 years ago, Lee Zeldin was 10 points further behind than my campaign right now. So we're in a much better position, and he lost the close race by 5 points. So we're going to win because we're going to make that up very easily.
The current New York 21 Representative Elise Stefanik announced last year that she would not run for re-election to that seat and would instead run for governor. But she dropped out of the race in December, and Blakeman subsequently received the state GOP gubernatorial nomination. The Clinton County GOP has endorsed New York 21st District Congressional candidate Robert Smullen over his primary opponent, Anthony Constantino. Committee Vice Chair Jeff Luck criticized President Donald Trump's endorsement of Constantino as he introduced Smullen on Saturday.
And I'm going to go off script right now, and I think everybody here knows that our President Trump clearly got it wrong.
Smullen, the current 118th District Assemblyman, thanked the county Republicans for remaining steadfast in their endorsement of his campaign.
I'm the only lifelong Republican in this race. I'm the one that I think best represents the values of the vast majority of the people of this district. We're at an inflection point. Our Congresswoman has spent 12 years in Congress, and I'm the right person to replace him.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
An environmental group is suing New York City, alleging it's not following necessary steps to change the upstate watershed that supplies city residents with water. The Legislative Gazette's Elias Guerra has more.
What's disappointing about the Riverkeepers lawsuit is they were involved in all of the negotiations up until the fall of last year.
That was Jeff Baker, an attorney with the coalition representing many communities in the Catskills watershed west of the Hudson River. He said the lawsuit by Riverkeeper against New York City is unfounded. The story of New York City getting its drinking water from the Catskills watershed goes back decades. The city entered into an agreement in 1997 with the State Department of Health and Environmental Conservation, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, individual towns and counties, and groups like Riverkeeper. The city bought hundreds of thousands of acres in the watershed to secure its water supply for millions of people. The agreement said New York City would receive unfiltered water from upstate and would compensate upstate communities for the cost of increased regulations. New York City also had to get a waiver for federal laws regulating drinking water called a filtration avoidance determination, which it gets from the EPA or State Department of Health. Negotiations about how New York City would continue to acquire land upstate, specifically the areas around streams that feed into the city's watershed, broke down over the summer. When the negotiations resumed in winter, Riverkeeper was not invited back. Baker guesses this is probably why Riverkeeper is bringing that lawsuit.
And all of the substantive points that they're complaining about regarding the land acquisition program and amendments to conservation easements were all agreed to by all the parties at the table, including Riverkeeper.
Riverkeeper did not agree with that assessment and said in their lawsuit that the New York City Department of Environmental Protection is not following the environmental review process at all.
If Riverkeeper had agreed that this was in the best interest of those 9.5 million New Yorkers who drink unfiltered water from the water supply, our signature would be on the document.
That was Riverkeeper Legal Program Director Mike DuLong, who said the latest deal also does not include the Streamside Acquisition Program, which would protect the watershed streams and avoid the unnecessary buying up of land upstate communities could otherwise use to develop. The lawsuit also says the side agreement allows for construction like gravel mining and developing renewables instead of leaving land undeveloped and undermines the purpose of the city's purchase, Dulong said. Baker said this is grossly overstated.
But the conservation easement that was ultimately put in between the city and state was far too restrictive, and it really limited things like minor utilities, crossings, some necessary road areas, and other things.
Dulong said while Riverkeeper supports upstate communities, the city needs to go through all the right processes.
What has to happen before that takes place is a full environmental analysis of what the impacts of those developments are going to be on these lands that were supposed to have been conserved in perpetuity, forever.
The New York City Law Department said, quote, the city is not commenting while the case is under review, end quote. I'm Elias Guerra.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York really is the Big Apple. The state is the second largest in the country to produce apples, averaging 29.5 million bushels of production annually. That's according to the USDA. But on a recent Tuesday morning, apple farmers were hit with a late spring freeze with temperatures that left many orchards devastated with severe crop loss. The New York Public News Network's Kimberly Izar has more.
Brett Buddy grows all sorts of apple varieties at his farm, Majestic Farm. Crimson Crisps, Pristines, Golden Russets.
One that I really like is called an Asopus Spitzenberg, and that's a native New York apple. You can find it. It was discovered by the Asopus Reservoir.
But his favorite is a sweet, tangy apple called the Ashmead's Kernel that he says tastes unbelievable.
It has the most insane flavor. The intensity is like an apple Jolly Rancher, but it has high acid notes, and then it's also sweet as well. And they're kind of ugly, too. They have a russeted skin. They're mostly yellow, but then they get this beautiful orange glow on one side of them where the sun hits them.
Buddy has about 2,500 apple trees at his farm in Mountaindale in Sullivan County. But this year, Buddy isn't so confident that he'll have any apples for sale at his farm. During the early morning hours last Tuesday, the Hudson Valley and Greater Northeast region were hit with an overnight frost. Temperatures dropped to as low as 19 degrees in some parts of upstate New York. This came after several days of warm weather that put apple buds into full bloom. For some farmers, the sudden frost meant a near total loss for their fruit crops.
According to the frost charts, it is 100% loss. And I haven't had, usually I go out there and you can slice your buds open and see if there's like a brown, you'll see brownness where the seeds go and stuff like that. And I just don't have it in my heart to really go look.
Apples are New York's most valuable crop, with the state being the second largest apple producer in the country. Jared Bono, director of Cornell University's Hudson Valley Research Laboratory, says Hudson Valley apples are especially vulnerable to erratic weather patterns.
We're further south. Our trees wake up earlier, which means there was more exposed sensitive tissue. You know, buds, green leaves, even flowers in the case of stone fruit. Anything below freezing for an extended period of time damages stuff.
Many New York farms in low-lying frost pockets, where cold air accumulates, attempted frost protection efforts last week.
A lot of farms were taking measures like using wind machines, hiring helicopters to blow the air out, even lighting fires in the alleyways and things with brush to keep the temperatures up. Everybody employed what they could.
Daniel Heavens is the co-owner of Quartz Rock Vineyard in Marlborough in Ulster County. He says last week's frost has left his farm with significant losses.
The cold air kind of hung out a bit, and in the low-lying pockets of the farm, it killed off more of the fruit. So we have some pockets where 90% of the grapes were just lost. They're just shriveled. You know, it looks like the leaves and the buds that came out are burnt a few days later. So they're just shriveled up and they're dying off. The apples, it doesn't look good right now. So for the apples, there's still bloom out there, but they're dead.
He says climate change and extreme weather changes has made farming increasingly unpredictable.
The more I describe agriculture to people that aren't necessarily familiar with the agricultural world, it's really like gambling. You can't control certain things. Mother Nature's in charge, and you can try to influence that, like with the wind machines, like with the helicopters, like with the burning of barrels or smudge pots. But it's, you know, Mother Nature is fully in charge.
Brett Buddy of Majestic Farm agrees. He says climate change in the region looks more subtle than some realize.
Climate change does not have to be this exotic, crazy event where your neighborhood is flooded. Like, the damage to these apple buds is dictated by a few degrees, and most climate change actually affects us that way. When I put this orchard in 8 years ago, I looked back at all the weather data for 100 years, and it was clear to me from the weather data that we would lose a crop every 1 to 7 years, and we have lost a crop 3 times now to weather. So that's significant. It's a big deal.
Still, farmers are trying to stay positive. Heavens at Quartz Rock Vineyard says the apples this season may be misshaped, but they're still going to taste delicious. In Liberty, I'm Kimberly Izar for the New York Public News Network.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2618. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.
Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.